Welcome to The Plants We Eat, an investigation of the history, biology, and culture of the plants that we use for food. I'm Jeff Gilman, director of the UNC Charlotte Botanical Gardens and plant history enthusiast.
And I'm Cindy Proctor, teacher at Central Piedmont Community College in Charlotte and also a landscape urban consultant.
And today we're going to talk about Frankenstein.
All right.
Really, it's exciting.
It is exciting. How do we eat that?
So the fruit we're going to talk about today is the apple.
Okay.
And the apple is, I think, of the apple as Frankenstein's monster, because we've played with it for so long, messed with it so long, that it's no longer like a regular, it's not what nature intended.
That's right.
Put it that
There's
way.
There's nothing original about
There's
it.
There's nothing original no. about it. So many of these foods that we talk about, they at least have a close resemblance to what nature was trying to produce. The apple, no, not really. So now the apple, there are about 80 different species or so of apple, or I'm sorry, not 80, closer to 50. And they're originally from, the apples we eat are originally from Central Asia, including modern Russia and China. And there are a number of species, as I said, around 50 from really all over the world. We certainly have some here in the United States, mostly not what we'd consider edible apples, many in Europe, many in Asia. The thing about the apple, though, is that when you think about an apple, you think about a particular type of apple. And I'm actually going to do something a little bit different. So Alex is our sound guy. He does all the technical stuff for us, does a great job with that. And he knows absolutely nothing about, he knows absolutely nothing about horticulture. So Alex, can I ask you a quick question?
Yes.
Okay. Alex, tell me what type of peaches there are out there.
I wouldn't know.
Okay.
Can you type of peach?
Okay, so you'd know no type of peach. Could you tell me a type of apple?
The Granny Smith.
How about that?
There you go.
He knew Granny Smith right off the top of his head.
The one you cook with.
That's right. And that's the way the apple is. There are a tremendous number of apple cultivars, and we buy our apples based on what type they are. Now, there are actually a tremendous number of peaches, too, which mm-hmm. we'll talk about in an upcoming show. You've got your June Gold, you've got your Red Haven, you've got your Jersey Queen, whole lot of peaches. But when people go to the store, they're not buying peaches based on the type of peach. They're buying peaches based on pretty much how big they are,
or
how
freshest,
they look.
Or a little, maybe not too hard, but a little soft. Yes.
Exactly.
But with apples, it's color, isn't it?
Well, it's color, but it's cultivar.
Okay.
Cultivar. And by the way, cultivar has a specific meaning in horticulture. It's cultivated variety. Mm-hmm. In other words, somebody finds a type of apple that they like and they cultivate it, and then everybody can have that variety. And there's a whole bunch out there. Alex pointed out Granny Smith, but besides Granny Smith, there's also things like Red Delicious. There's things like Honeycrisp. You may have heard of,
Gala.
Gala, Fuji. Absolutely.
Golden Delicious.
Golden Delicious, right. My favorite, by the way, and I'm kind of in the minority on this, is Red Delicious.
It's the top most producing apple in mm-hmm. the country.
Yeah, I grew up on a small apple orchard.
Oh, that's right. I keep forgetting that. Okay.
And Red Delicious, it's basically one of the apples that we grew, so it's one that I have just an attachment to.
Okay.
So Red Delicious actually came out around 1870. Many of you have heard of Macintosh. Macintosh came out around 1811. Many of you have heard of Honeycrisp. Honeycrisp currently is the apple that I'd say is most in demand. It was introduced to the public in 1991. It's actually patented in 1988, so patented about 3 years before it was delivered. So anyway, let me back up a little bit. So of the there are about 7,500 different apple cultivars. Okay,
gosh.
Over 7,500 different varieties of apples. Having said that, there's actually a USDA bulletin that came out in 1905 that was talking about the known varieties of apples from 1804 to 1904, and that listed 17,000 types of apples. And I've read this bulletin, by the way. And
that's impressive on its own.
It's insane. There's literally 400 pages of lists of different varieties. Now, were there duplicates? I feel certain that there were duplicates.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Oftentimes, one apple will get produced by a few different people, and they'll name it the same thing.
Yeah,
or they'll give it a different name.
Sometimes, depending on where it's grown, it can change its appearance, its taste, its, you know, lots of, you know. So that they might have confused that, too.
They might have confused that, or somebody might have just gotten an apple and decided, hey, you know what, I'll just rename this, even though it's exactly the same thing as, you know, it's a delicious, but I think it looks a little bit different, so.
We'll name it.
so I'll give it my own name. And, yeah, unfortunately, that's pretty common. So over 7,500 different types of apple cultivars. Not only are there over 7,500 different types of apple cultivars, these cultivars are grown in an incredibly diverse variety of ways, because when you buy a delicious apple tree, if you've ever purchased a delicious apple tree, what you find pretty quickly is that this delicious apple tree may grow in a variety of ways depending on the rootstock it's put on. See, that's where the whole Frankenstein monster thing comes in. Apples aren't grown on their own roots, and they're not grown from seed either. Let's make this clear, because a lot of people don't realize this. If you take a red delicious apple and you take the seeds from this red delicious apple and you plant them, will you get a red delicious apple?
No.
Right, because those seeds have certainly a red delicious mother, but the pollen will come from a different apple, and it could be a wide variety of different apples. Now, apples actually have a feature which makes it such that not only are the seeds different, they are very different. So a red delicious mother could have seedlings that are just widely, widely different.
Yeah, the Red Delicious is a significantly larger apple than the others. You could have a child. It could have a child that be the size of a golf ball.
Exactly. Yeah. And that frequently happens. And it could have literally inedible children. And in fact, that happens often.
Sure, it does. Sure.
So breeding programs have to plant a whole lot of seed to get a tree that is That's useful.
Does that mean why some of our apples are expensive?
That's why some of our apples are. In fact, I'll talk about Honeycrisp in a little bit.
Okay.
And we'll talk about why apples are so expensive. Anyway, so Red Delicious can only be reproduced through grafting. Cuttings, which is where you take a stem and you try and grow roots on that stem, does not work very well on most of your apples. So they have to be grafted. Now, this grafting is actually very technical with apples.
Good at it, though. You're good at grafting.
No, actually, I'm not very. I'm okay.
You're okay?
I've done enough grafting that I've gotten okay at it, but I'm not great. Once upon a time, grafting was done just to further the cultivar. So you have a good cultivar of apple. You take a stem of that and you graft it onto whatever seedling apple you could find, okay? So pretty straightforward. You have a stem of an apple you like. You have a tree out in the nursery that is growing, but the apples are lousy. You cut it off at the base. You pop the new stem in with proper grafting technique, and boom, you're going to have that variety produced.
So you have a rootstock from another plant and the top part of the cultivar.
Exactly.
Hence the Frankenstein.
Hence the Frankenstein. Well, we haven't gotten to the Frankenstein.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But you're closing in on it. Once upon a time, that's how things were done. When I say once upon a time, we're talking about Roman times. Anymore, what we have is a situation where people actually select the rootstock that they use. Now, this rootstock does have to be reproduced in a different way, something called mound layering. And certain apple trees take well to this mound layering. What's mound layering? Basically, what happens is you pile up soil around the base of an apple tree, which you want to reproduce. There are a bunch of, hopefully, shoots coming out. You purposely pick this plant, and you purposely train it to have a whole lot of shoots coming around close to the soil. You mound the soil up around all these shoots. You nick all of these shoots at the base. You treat them with a special hormone, and suddenly you have a whole lot of mini trees. Okay, that's how they vegetatively reproduce rootstock. And then you take these rootstocks and you pop your cultivar on top of these special rootstocks. Now, why are these rootstocks special? These rootstocks are special because they have certain properties that the apple growers really, really want. These properties can be very wide-reaching and very wide-ranging. Some of the most important are insect resistance, and more important than that, dwarfing.
That's right.
Dwarfing. Dwarfing is huge in apples.
Because they grow fairly tall. If you tried to pick an apple from a 30-foot, 40-foot tall tree.
And that's exactly, and you've right. got the, well, you're a horticulturist. Yeah. an apple from a seed, a normal apple, is going to grow 30 or 40 feet mm-hmm. tall. And if we were rooting cuttings of a delicious apple tree, it would grow to 30, 40, perhaps even 50 feet tall.
Yes. Think of the labor involved.
Exactly. And the liability.
The liability.
For people climbing the trees.
Yes.
And liability is actually huge.
Yes.
And you actually, believe it or not, you get more production from smaller trees also. Because apples only grow where light hits the tree. Mm-hmm. So if the trees are smaller, you actually have more light hitting more trees in your orchard.
Right. They're easier to manage, but I'll get into that later. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So we want a dwarf tree. Mm-hmm. So we have these dwarfing rootstocks. And we put our delicious apple or our Macintosh apple or our Honeycrisp apple onto these dwarfing rootstock. So dwarfing rootstocks have actually been known since about 328 BC. Aristotle actually found a dwarfing rootstock from 328 BC. In the 1500s, there was a dwarf rootstock that was regularly used. It was called paradise, and this paradise rootstock was used almost exclusively. The reason people were using dwarf rootstocks in the 1500s was, first of all, to get that dwarf tree, but it did one other thing. It also brings trees into bearing sooner. Okay, what do I mean by bring trees into bearing sooner? Well, normally, if you have a seedling, it'll be at least 10 years before you get an apple on the tree, or around 10 years before you get an apple on the tree. When you graft onto a rootstock, you have production within 2 years.
Yes.
So that's
also a big deal.
It's a big deal. Mm-hmm. You have a lot of production faster. So after the 1500s, there were a whole lot of dwarfing rootstocks developed in the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, and there was really no way to keep track of them. People just had these dwarfing rootstocks, and oh boy, oh boy. And they were identified, by the way. You'd find an apple tree grown from a seed, and it grew small. And then you'd just use that mound layering, and you'd reproduce that tree. And then you'd graft onto that tree, and if it produced dwarfs, then you kept using that. So a lot of different dwarfing rootstocks were developed. Well, in the early 1900s, Sir Ronald Hatton of the East Malling Research Station in Kent, England, he got all the dwarfing rootstocks that he could and tried to sort them out. Some of these clones were probably ancient. Some of them may have even come from Aristotle's time as far as we know. So rather than using the names that they came with when he got them from various places around Europe, he gave them all new names. Since he was at the East Malling Research Station, he gave them all the letter M. And then he added a number to it based on where they were in the plot. So there'd be M7, M9, M26. In total, although he collected a whole bunch of different rootstocks, he only found 27 that he felt were actually unique.
Well, that's typical in breeding programs.
Right, yeah. There's redundancy.
Yes.
So there were 27 rootstocks, and you've got all these. You've got M1 through M27, and the M1, some people, when they first learn about rootstocks, they make the assumption that M1 is going to be the shortest and M27 the tallest.
Oh, wow, no.
No, it had nothing to do with that. It was just the numbers from where they were in his research plot. Of these M series, two are common today, M9 and M7, and M9 is really it's really one of the dominant rootstocks today. In fact, I would say the dominant rootstock. Besides the East Malling rootstocks, there are a number that have been developed since then. One is the MM series. The MM series is known to be resistant to woolly apple aphid. And the MM series, MM111, is a pretty common one. They're resistant to the woolly apple aphid, so they're pretty common. And again, these dwarfing rootstocks, you can customize the tree that you get through these dwarfing rootstocks. You get a really small one, you can have a delicious apple tree that grows to about 7 to 8 feet tall. Or you can pick a slightly more vigorous one, and you could have your delicious apple tree grow to about 20 to 25 feet tall. Mm-hmm. Really depends upon the rootstock which you select. Now, let's say that you want a really strong root system but a really short tree. See, the thing about some of these dwarfing rootstocks is that they'll actually dwarf the tree so much that it can't be self-standing. You actually need to stake it. So you can actually have a rootstock which is vigorous, which is really strong and will hold the tree well. Then you can use an interstock, in other words, a tiny little piece of rootstock between the rootstock and the scion, the thing at the top, the Honeycrisp, which will dwarf the top of the tree, and then you can have the tree itself. So you can have, say, an MM111 at the base for a more vigorous rootstock, an M9 interstock to keep the top of the tree small, and then a Honeycrisp top. It's
crazy.
It's just amazing.
Now, that sounds pretty Frankensteinish to me.
It is pretty Frankensteinish.
Okay, so we're at the Frankenstein part.
And to take it one step further now, because, of course, there is one step further. Have you noticed that there are GMO apples now?
No.
There are GMO apples now. These are called the Arctic apples, and this is a collection of apples that don't brown, because that's a big deal.
Yeah,
that is. You know, when you cut into an apple, they brown quickly. And so these GMO apples include, so you know that with GMOs, basically what you do is you take your cultivar, and then you transform your cultivar. You do a very specific change to the cultivar itself. So you can now buy the Arctic Golden, the Arctic Granny, the Arctic Fuji.
So sometimes when hybridizers do this kind of thing, it changes the flavor. Have you tried an Arctic?
I have not tried an Arctic.
Okay.
Have you tried an Arctic?
No.
I actually really do want to try an Arctic, but I have not yet. The GMO thing, I have to admit, does not scare me, because really all you're doing is taking an apple and adding a gene, and it's really not that big.
I'm not that scared of it either.
No,
I just
GMOs
know
are something that I've dealt with at both the scientific level and at the cultural level for a long time, and they just haven't shown any of the issues that we're supposed to be afraid of. So I just don't have much concern.
Well, when you think about what they're doing with the apple, the Arctic, mm-hmm. is that by not by creating an apple that doesn't turn brown when you cut it, means we don't have to apply a lot of, who knows what they're, when you buy those sliced apples and they have stuff in them to keep them from browning, I don't know what that
is. It does reduce the chemistry afterwards.
So,
I don't know what they're using.
So that might be a good thing, but that's not why we're not going to here to discuss that.
That's
fascinating, actually.
It's pretty cool that they have them out there, and I do look forward to trying them out. Have you heard of the grapple?
No. I think I have, but no, I guess no. Is it grabbing an apple?
No, it actually stands for grape and apple. An apple and seep it in grape juice to make it sweeter. Not a fan, but that's okay.
Yeah. Necessary for me.
not necessarily at all. No discussion of apples is complete without discussing, first of all, organics and apples, mm-hmm. because apples are one of the fruits that we see most advertised as being organic. And it drives me a little bit crazy, because the thought seems to be that if we walk into an apple orchard that's been conventionally producing apples and we shout out, "Hey, y'all are going to be produced organically," that all of a sudden we won't need any pesticides and the insects and disease will just fly away and the apples are going to be beautiful and red. And that's actually the furthest thing from the truth. Apples are sprayed a lot for a reason. There are four major pests of apples, a lot of minor pests, but four major pests, just to name them, fire blight, apple scab, coddling moth, and apple maggot. And growing up, I got to tell you, I probably ate a lot of apple maggots. In fact, I know I ate a lot of apple maggots.
I could go so many places with that.
let's not. but to control these pests, it takes a reasonable amount of spraying. And these sprays are basically necessary. You can do a certain amount of control without using sprays, but not to the level that most customers would want when they walk into a grocery store. So when you see an apple produced organically, they're still probably sprayed quite a bit. There are certain areas of the country, like Washington State, where you have to spray less, but you're still usually spraying the apple.
Well, they're spraying things that are deemed organic, and that's really where the—
Right, exactly. But we don't want to equate organic with safe. And that's the big problem to me, is that a lot of these organic compounds are just as dangerous as the synthetics. And there's this assumption that because they're organic pesticides, they're somehow safer. And that's actually kind of ridiculous.
Right.
We don't even need to go into that. But if you look up some of the compounds that they use, they can be pretty dangerous. And the thing is, not only can they be dangerous, typically— because they don't last very long, they have to be reapplied and reapplied and reapplied. And if you're sitting there thinking, natural compounds, they've got to be safer. Rattlesnake bite, perfectly natural, but kind of dangerous.
Right.
If you're interested in some of the compounds, you can look up pyrethrum, you can look up copper sulfate, a lot of these different copper compounds.
I'm sure they apply oils in the wintertime.
They apply oils. Sometimes they'll apply neem. Sometimes they'll apply spinosad. Anyway, long story short, don't think that because it says organic, they're not being sprayed. The other thing is, because they're organic, sometimes it's assumed that nutritionally they're better. I want to take vitamin C as an example because when I read this, I was just blown away. Vitamin C is sometimes slightly higher in plants or in organic crops than it is in conventionally grown crops. But here's the thing: there's more difference in vitamin C between the types of apple that you get, then you'll see difference in a certain apple because it's organically produced.
You know, that's not where I thought you were going with that sentence.
Where do you think I was going?
I don't know, but I didn't realize that there are differences in the kind. Okay.
They're tremendous. There are tremendous differences. Look, a Delicious and a Macintosh are always going to have low levels of vitamin C. Can you make them slightly higher by growing them organically? Maybe. But the thing is, if you get a Sturmer or a Cavill Blanc, it's going to have tremendous amounts of vitamin C. It's just the way it is. Certain varieties of apples have higher levels of vitamin C.
So your favorite, the Red Delicious.
The Red Delicious is low.
My least favorite is the Red Delicious. Okay.
And finally, you know, I've got to say just a couple of words about Johnny Appleseed.
Because of course you do. He's really the reason why we have so many varieties. I know that's here in the United States, but, you know.
So Johnny Appleseed's real name was John Chapman. He was born in 1774. So Johnny Appleseed, John Chapman, what he did was he planted apple seeds all across the United States. I have to say that, I think that what he did was kind of cool. What he did was plant seed. Mm-hmm. And so because he planted all these seeds, I think that he gave rise to the concept of trying all these different types of apples. But the question then becomes, were any of these apple seeds that he planted, did they actually produce cultivars? And I don't know.
You don't think they contributed?
I don't know that there's a thing. Certainly they contributed pollen, and potentially they contributed, egg. But were any of them actual cultivars? I've looked and looked, and I can't find a single cultivar that's attributed to John Chapman. Now, the other thing we have to remember about John Chapman is that he never grafted plants. He was a member of the Swedenborgian Church, and he actually believed that grafting caused plants to suffer, according to what I've read. So he wouldn't graft plants. He believed you had to grow from seed.
Maybe he was just a great marketeer.
I think that's
because
part
he just,
of it.
He just kind of spread seeds all around, you know, different parts of the country. And
well, that was his thing.
Yeah, he loved to do that.
He died in 1845. He owned 1,200 acres of land, a string of nurseries. He never married. A really interesting guy who obviously promoted the apple, but, you know, did he really lend much to the cultivars that we know and use today? And I can't answer that one way or the other. I don't know.
Well, he's still an interesting fellow nonetheless.
nonetheless.
Well, you know, talking about vitamin C, we all have heard an apple a day keeps the doctor away. And I saw that it came from that old English adage, to eat an apple before going to bed will make the doctor beg his bread. I just thought that was fun. But, you know, did you know that apples are grown in all 50 states? And from a landscaper like myself, that's fascinating because it is from the Rosaceae family, mm-hmm. and giving rise to why it has so many diseases. Mm-hmm. And in the South here, I mean, we don't grow them. The mountains do in North Carolina. But, you know, in the South, we don't.
Now, there's a couple of crabs, but honestly, they don't do well.
You know, I looked up that. And that it's real helpful to look online, because no matter where you are in the country, you can grow an apple in your backyard. We're not looking at growing an orchard here. Okay, so there are some choices. And, you know, urban horticulture is my thing. I feel like that there's always a way to grow that in your backyard, that there's no problem we can overcome. But when it comes to apples, I feel a little discouraged. However, I did come across some websites and nurseries that you put in your zip code. And they give a recommendation because they can tailor that rootstock and that scion to your area. And that's really how you should buy your apple.
The whole Frankenstein monster thing, because there's been so much work with the rootstocks and the tops of the plants, they can pick out.
Well, grafting is wonderful. I mean, right. it has a lot of impact in ornamental world, not just food. So, but anyway, because of the grafting and the rootstock and the scion options, then there's no reason why you can't try. Okay, and I'm going to try Golden Delicious for our area. That's what they recommended. But nonetheless, you can grow them all in 50 states. I mean, they're grown commercially in 36 states. I mean, that's promising.
That is big.
Given that it's from the Rosaceae family, I would have never guessed. Yeah. You know, I would have thought California and Washington and New York New York State have the market, you know, on apples.
But you know, it's really interesting to say the Rosaceae family because we don't think about it, but apples, peaches, plums, apricots, almonds.
Everything we eat fruit-wise.
Most of the things we eat fruit-wise are from the Rosaceae. So there's and because we cultivate them so much, because there's so many rosaceous plants out there, related plants out there, there's just this tremendous number of pests that attack.
Right. And they thrive in heat and humidity, which is what, you know, the Southeast has a good bit of.
Right.
That's why I'm so surprised that you can grow them in every state. You know,
exactly.
There's just a little, you know, hiccups here and there you have to follow. But you know, how do you choose a variety? But first of all, before we get to that, did you know what the state flower of Michigan is?
No, but I bet you're about to tell me.
The apple blossom.
Is it? That's cool.
Yeah, that is. Yeah. I did that for you.
Yeah.
and did you know the crab apple is the only apple native to North America?
No, I did not realize that. Do you know how many species of apples are native to North America? Just the one?
It says the crab apple is the only apple native to North America.
Okay.
which is helpful for pollination. But we'll get to that in just a minute. So when you have a backyard, you want to try an apple, and you're in urban conditions, like all of us, most of us anyway, are how do you choose a variety? Well, first you need to think about the size of your area. And you dabbed into that a little bit. I mean, you can buy a standard size, but it is going to grow 30 feet tall. There is a semi-dwarf size, and it can get to about 15 feet. And then there's a dwarf size that you can get at 8 feet. But it doesn't matter, because you can manipulate any tree because of the rootstock like you described. But make sure what you're buying is one of those three, depending on the size that you have available. Now, most of the times, it's best to have a pollinator. Even though they're self-pollinating, it's recommended that you have a pollinator. And crabapple could be one of them that's planted at least 100 feet away. So even if you had two apple trees, what's wrong with that? You know, which I always recommend when you're trying to grow for fruit, because, you know, you just might get a dud, you know, in the trade. So figure out the space you have. So figure out if you can have full sun. So this is why it surprises me, because any protection from the sun, which is what we need here in the South, will limit your fruit production, because every branch needs to have a sun exposure so it can produce fruits for you. And that is going to come into play also, because when you maintain it, you have to prune it and stuff like that. But I'll get to that in a minute. So can you, can you correct the soil, which we all can correct the soil? I'm always going to be a big advocate of that, from compaction that may occur in urban areas. Always add organic matter because it's been scraped away. Lots of mulch. So make sure that you can provide that. And we talked about the heat load already. And are you able to tend to your apples, like monitor them anyway, from like April to November? And I don't mean go out there every day in a chair and stare at them, but just kind of every, you know, week or every couple of weeks, just go out there and check them out and see if there's anything that you need to do. So that those are the big five things that I think you need to look for when wanting to plant an apple tree. I can tell you have a question. What is it?
Yeah. Just for the backyard grower, are you an advocate of using pesticides?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I do want to.
I mean, ever since we have developed that IPM strategy, integrated pest management, where you're accommodating a threshold of pests and disease, but keeping it under control as needed. That's really the backbone of IPM, instead of just blanketly spraying, you know, certain times of the year. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know,
so limited spraying.
Limited spraying as needed.
I do have one suggestion for the backyard grower who wants to avoid pesticides as much as possible. There are actually bags that you can put around the apples when they're growing. This is really for a backyard grower. This isn't for commercial growing.
Okay.
Time and labor intensive. When the fruit is about the size of a quarter or so, you can actually put a bag around it. And by bag, you could actually use a clear plastic bag, but you can buy commercial bags. I believe there's something called start bagging. So look up start bagging. And it's this cloth bag that you put around the fruit. You leave that bag around the fruit for the entire season. The fruit grows into the bag, and when it ripens, you just take it off the tree, and it keeps insects off of it.
So it's a cloth bag so it can breathe.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Well, you know, if you're going to choose the dwarf varieties, you know, then that may be doable.
Absolutely.
Because really for a backyard gardener, I know you said for an orchard purposes, they're going to produce quite a bit more. But those are different environments. When you have a dwarf variety in your backyard, you're probably going to get about 2 to 3 bushels a year.
Right.
And that's fair. That's a fair amount for a backyard. You know, a 20-foot plant might give you like, oh gosh, 20 bushels. You know, but how can you pick it and maintain it if it's 20, 30 feet tall and then some? So kind of weigh your options here. And I don't know of a family that could eat 20 bushels.
No,
anyway,
I don't either.
Okay, so hopefully a dwarf or a semi-dwarf is something that I could influence you, you know, to use in your backyard, because you can manage it better in terms of picking it, maintaining it. But let's talk about when to plant it. So hopefully, I do love bare roots for fruit trees.
Right.
You know, for other things, I'm not a fan. But when it comes to fruit, it's really important that you establish them in the spring, or plant them in the spring and get them established. And bare root is the way to go. So, make sure you're buying from a reputable source, and hopefully you've done a little bit of research. And, you know, Extension can always help you with that, as well as websites, just like the one I said. I just put in my zip code and it gave me some options, and they even had a phone number I could talk, you know.
That's great.
I thought it was wonderful. So you want to install your bare root around April or May.
And just to be clear, bare root, you actually, is the cheapest way to ship. It comes with bare roots. It's generally a small plant. There's one thing that they haven't mentioned yet. You might be about to mention. We got to talk about planting depth with a bare root.
Yes, I'm just getting ready to
do
that.
Go ahead.
So yes, just like with most grafted things, you don't want to cover the grafted union between the scion or the top of the plant and the rootstock. And it's pretty obvious. It's kind of a Frankensteinist
right.
looking in itself. You know, I'm not going to ever forget that now. So it's kind of a swollen base that exists at the top. From the top and the bottom, the rootstock, and you don't want to cover that up. Is that what you were
going to?
Yes. And that's always the truth with roses, even with, again, anything that's grafted. But please, with your apple trees, make sure that you don't bury that. Now, one thing that is a demise to apple trees is too wet of a soil. So in urban conditions, we're always battling compacted soil. So make sure that it's very well drained soil, which can be done with lots of organic matter. I'm going to feel like a broken record. Now, if you do plant a containerized apple tree that is showing some leaf growth, then you need to get it in the ground as soon as possible to help it, you know, through that transplant option. The girdling roots is a big issue, especially with apple trees. So make sure you spread those roots out. That is really the backbone of growing apples, or really anything.
Yeah. You know? One point that's worth making is that there are a lot of plants that are more difficult to transplant. Fruit trees tend to be among the more difficult.
I agree, and that's why I'm such a fan of the bare root, and you're right, it is a lot cheaper.
Let me tell you something with fruits. If at first you don't succeed, try again. I mean, with some plants, I say, look, if you didn't succeed with that, not going to succeed with anything. Look,
I'm like that with any plant.
Right.
I do. I try three times.
Okay.
And then I'm done.
All right.
Because I just kind of choke it up to...
And I think that if you plant an apple and it doesn't succeed... Plant another apple.
Of course. Yeah. You should, absolutely, because you don't know. I mean, apples aren't widgets, or plants aren't widgets. They're something could have been wrong with it or whatever. You'll never know. So the key, though, is, okay, we've talked about choosing a variety and planting it. But after you've planted it, the key is choosing and the right branches to keep and building a great tree. Mm-hmm. All right. So, and that is a scaffold. So you want to create a tree that has some 3 to 4 good scaffold branches. And I mean like side branches that have wide angles. And I know you're going to love this, at about 60 degrees. And that way it can hold the weight of your apples and give you some good bearing fruit branching. Yep. And that
they should be, so it's, meaning they're more upright, 3 or 4 more upright branches to hold. Yeah, absolutely.
With wide angles.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is when a tree starts growing, especially when it's young, it's very frantic. And some of the branches are just, they don't have good union with the main trunk. And so you're going to remove those and promote the ones that have, you know, about a 60 degree angle to them.
Right.
Now, you're going to prune, even though an apple tree blooms on old wood, okay, you're going to prune every spring to build this better tree, all right, and to promote that scaffolding that I just talked about. Now, you're going to do this after the danger of frost is what I recommend. Now, your trees aren't going to start producing fruit if you've chosen a dwarf at about year three, two to three, depending on the size of tree that you got.
Yep.
Now, once it starts to produce fruit, have you ever seen, well, sure, of course you have, you've seen it produce fruit. It has a cluster of fruit, kind of like, I hate cherries.
Yes.
You know, it looks like a little cherries on there.
Well, maybe not quite as many as cherries, but yeah, it produces a cluster.
Right. So you want to remove some of those excess fruiting, if you will.
If you're putting the bags on, you want to do it right before you put the bags
on.
When they're about a quarter in
That's
size.
Right.
When I was a kid, that was actually a thing we used to do.
That your job, is to remove the excess fruit?
Thinning.
Yes, I know. That's what it's called.
Myself and my brother and sister, and sometimes some of our friends, and it'd be a couple of afternoons, and we'd go out there and just thin the apple trees.
It could be a party.
Oh, let me tell you.
You didn't think it was a party. Okay.
I
would have thought it was a party. But you should, because a tree is going to grow more fruit than it can hold.
Yes.
So that's very important that you do this in the summer after you see, you know, when they're about, let's say the size of a grape, maybe, you start thinning them and keeping what did you guys do? Keep a few per spur?
Actually, we'd usually keep one, sometimes two per spur.
Did you really? Okay.
Yeah, that was it. There's no reason to keep a lot.
I see. Okay.
And you get maximum size when you thin out. Although there's also natural thinning. I'd say even years when we didn't thin, we'd still get a decent crop.
Did you? Yeah. Well, you know, I read, this surprised me, I read that it does biennial fruiting sometimes if you don't do this. In other words, every other year it has a great fruiting season.
I'd say we typically, many trees will tend towards that.
I would
definitely say that the apples.
Well, this is trying to prevent. You're trying to
prevent that.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Trying to prevent that. So, I mean, that's basically. I think that this would be a great choice, given you don't have the heat load that we have. But you know, I'm going to try it. I'm going to try. In the summertime is when you really should start looking for the diseases that you mentioned, especially the maggot. You know, fire blight and maggot, I think, are the biggest
apple
ones.
Apple bags, stay away from the maggots.
And yes, so the apple bags will help you with the maggots. The fire blight can be a little tricky. You're going to have to spray for that. And that shows up in the spring, and that has like a dieback to it.
It can be major.
It can be major.
Fire blight can be major.
It can be major. And even if you get fire blight and you want to remove the tree as another, I would try again.
I would.
And just try a different spraying program but that's not even close to fruiting time, so it won't affect your fruit.
Yep.
Another way you could do these is by espaliering.
Oh, no.
No? Would you do that?
I think espalier is great, but I think it's too much work.
Too much work.
For me. That doesn't mean other people won't love it.
That's right. So espaliering is something that royalty did a good bit in their kitchen gardens, in England especially. And I saw that there was columnar trees available. See, they can do a lot of monstering here.
Yes. The apple is a monster.
Well, that's just interesting in itself right there. So go ahead and grow them in your backyard garden with just a couple of routine checks. And
always grow two.
Always grow two.
So that you can, the apple does not fertilize itself.
It doesn't.
It really needs
a friend. It can be a crab apple.
Yep.
Or crap apple, however you look
however
at it.
You want to put it.
Okay. All right. Well, I've learned a lot from you.
And I've learned from you. This is a fun one, a long one. And I feel like we've barely touched it.
Yes. That's how some of these are going to work.
There are a million rabbit holes with the apple.
That's right.
Thank you for listening to The Plants We Eat, and we look forward to talking to you soon.